if you're a Zionist, how can you defend not being in Israel? Rabbi Soloveitchik is a model of a Zionist who did not live in Israel.
We've been studying Rabbi Soloveitchik not only in the context of the library, not only in the context of the many books that he wrote, but also in the context of the life that he lived. And in the life that he lived, there was in 1948 a huge, consequential inflection point in Jewish history. In this lecture, we're going to learn about what Rabbi Soloveitchik thought about Zionism. What are we going to learn?
We're going to learn that once again, Rabbi Soloveitchik was thoughtful, nuanced, and careful in his assessments and in his formulations. Zionism is a very complex issue, was always a complex issue, and certainly today is the source of a great deal of thinking and debate, controversy, and commitment. There were those who were upset about Zionism from various opposite ends of the ideological spectrum. There were those who were so deeply committed to Zionism that they associated Zionism with messianism. The return of the Jewish people to Zion bespeaks hearing in the back and maybe even in the front of our minds and ears the footsteps of the Messiah. Rabbi Soloveitchik was in none of those places. Rabbi Soloveitchik deeply appreciated and understood the state of Israel as a divine manifestation. However, he was totally opposed to any kind of a messianic association with the state of Israel, and was opposed to those who became extremely nationalistic in their beliefs and actions, particularly after the Six-Day War of 1967, was very concerned about losing Jewish lives for the sake of holding on to land, and was a very public and outspoken figure in that conversation. We'll also notice that his is a diaspora Zionism. Here's a great rabbi, Jewish leader, who once in his life visited Israel. 1935, he attempted to become the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. It didn't work out. He came back to Boston, and that was it. His daughter, son-in-law, grandchildren moved to Israel. He didn't go to Israel. He didn't move to Israel. At some point, we will see, he was thinking that he would spend significant time in Israel. It didn't work out. So here we have somebody who's a Zionist and he's not living in Israel. And what does that mean? What does it mean to be a Zionist? Is that a tenable, defensible position? How can one be, or can one be, a Zionist? What I not imagine that a Zionist means that Zionism, the state of Israel, 1948, such a tremendous watershed in the history of the Jewish people, not only in modernity for the last 2,000 years. What am I doing in New York? What am I doing in Boston? What am I doing in Chicago? So those are the kinds of issues that we will be analyzing, once again underscoring the complexity of the thinking of this great individual. What does Zionism mean? What does it mean to be a Zionist? And in particular, what does it mean to be a Zionist living in the diaspora? Once the State of Israel is founded in 1948, there's a state of Israel. If you're a Zionist, why aren't you living in Israel? What does it mean to be a Zionist not living in Israel when one can live in the state of Israel? The life and the thought of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik gives us an opportunity to examine these issues. And here too, I want to divide my presentation, this unit, into two parts, one biographical and one more conceptual. First, by way of background, Zionism emerged in the second half of the 19th century as various nationalist movements across the world were gaining traction. And Jews, too, began to direct their attention to returning as a people to their ancestral homeland in Zion or Israel. This movement was mostly secular in its ideology and leadership, and it engendered much opposition in the traditional Jewish community. It was rooted not in traditional Jewish values. God will send Jews back to Israel when God is ready, they said. And for sure, many traditional Jews were uncomfortable identifying themselves with a movement that was led by non-observant Jews and animated by non-observant values. Prominent in the leadership of the traditionalist anti-Zionist camp were members of Rabbi Soloveitchik's own personal family. His great-grandfather, Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, after whom he was named. His grandfather, his paternal grandfather, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, who had, as we saw, a great influence on him. Both were leaders in this anti-Zionist movement, and we already had occasion to meet both of them on various opportunities. But there were also those who developed a pro-Zionist perspective. They were able to think about and formulate and articulate a religious Zionist approach. That it's possible, in fact, to be both religious and a Zionist. In 1902, there was a movement that was founded, a religious Zionist movement. It is known as Mizrahi. Mizrahi is a Hebrew word, but it's really not. It's a conflation of two Hebrew words. I will say them and translate them. Merkaz Ruchani, which means spiritual center. If you say Merkaz Ruchani quickly, a couple of times, it morphs into Mizrahi. Mizrahi is a made-up word in this context, and it means Israel can be a spiritual center. There's such a thing as religious Zionism. In one of the talks that Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered in the 1960s at a convention of the Religious Zionists of America, we're going to come back to that in a little while, he said as follows, source number one. This comes from a book entitled The Rav Speaks, and in this book we have summaries, again, not transcripts, and again, not written by Rabbi Soloveitchik himself, but considered to be authoritative representations of the talks that he gave every year at the annual convention in the 60s of the Religious Zionists of America. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, said, and then was described as having said, I was not born into, source number one, line number four, a Zionist household. This is a classic understatement by Rabbi Soloveitchik. My parents' ancestors, my father's house, my teachers and colleagues were far from the Mizrahi religious Zionists. They too held, quote, why meddle in the secrets of the Merciful One? My links with Mizrahi grew gradually. I had doubts about the validity of the Mizrahi approach. So his family is not providing for him being rooted in any kind of, remotely resembling any kind of a religious Zionist perspective. I mentioned briefly in unit number one that in 1935, Rabbi Soloveitchik traveled to the land of Israel, the only time ever in his life to do so, to try out for the position of the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He spent some 4 months in Israel, and when the votes were cast, Rabbi Moshe Avigdor Amiel, who was the chief rabbi of Antwerp, received 22 votes. Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, who was serving as the chief rabbi of Dublin, received 10 votes. Rabbi Soloveitchik received 9 votes. Picked himself up, he returned to Boston. He threw himself into community work and never returned to Israel for the rest of his life. It's one of those what if questions that some people like to pose. So what would have happened if he had gotten the 22 votes and in 1935 moved to Israel? But he didn't. He came back to the United States, devoted his full attention to first American Jewry and then beyond. In 1940, Rabbi Soloveitchik was a leader in an organization called Agudat Yisrael, which at best was neutral on Zionism. And then just a few years later, he changed his affiliation and he became a leader, probably the most prominent ideological leader of the religious Zionists of America called Mizrahi. And in that same talk, second to the next paragraph, in source number one, he explained the shift. If I now identify with the Mizrahi against my family tradition, so clearly the family tradition is significant to him. He realizes that he's going against his family tradition. It is only because, as previously clarified, I feel that divine providence, next line, employs secular Jews as instruments to bring to fruition his great plans regarding the land of Israel. The fact that secular Jews are involved in this, or maybe even leading this, doesn't mean that therefore it is unacceptable or inappropriate. I also believe, number two, that there would be no place for Torah in Israel today were it not for the Mizrahi. It is this particular political party and this ideology that allows for the flourishing of Torah in the state of Israel. And we'll see that for Rabbi Soloveitchik, the state of Israel was not an end in and of itself, but it was a way to help the Jewish people more closely appreciate and identify with a Torah way of life. And since this movement or this ideology or this political party does that, therefore it is important to support. I built an altar upon which I sacrificed sleepless nights, doubts, and reservations. Regardless, and now another element, the years of the Hitlerian Holocaust, the establishment of the State of Israel, and the accomplishments of the Mizrahi in the land of Israel convinced me of the correctness of our movement's path. So now, by the middle 40s, he is squarely ensconced in the world of religious Zionism, a foremost primary spokesperson for the ideology of religious Zionism. On Israel Independence Day in the year of 1956, Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered a major, major address in the Nathan Lamport Auditorium of Yeshiva University on 186th Street and Amsterdam Avenue in New York City, translated into English under the title Fate and Destiny. We already examined parts of this in the previous unit and before the previous unit, and I will return to this very shortly, where in this work, Rabbi Soloveitchik outlines most fully his perspective on the significance of the State of Israel. In 1959, following the biographical trajectory, following the death of the Ashkenazi chief rabbi Isaac Halevi Herzog, you remember I just mentioned to you that he came in second in 1935. He lost the battle, but he won the war, because a couple of years later, he became actually the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the land of Israel. And then when the land of Israel became the state of Israel, he was the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state of Israel, the longest ever serving chief rabbi in Israeli history, some 20 years. He passed away in 1959. There's now an opening. And Rabbi Soloveitchik in 1959 seriously considered succeeding Rabbi Herzog in his role as Ashkenazi chief rabbi. It was a huge amount of talk at the time. This was a big deal. Should he come? Will he come? He himself was vacillating, trying to decide, ultimately decided against it. We saw in Unit 2, one of the reasons why he gave that he decided against it. You remember the quote about, I want to stay within the four cubits of halacha. Basically, he felt that the chief rabbinate position was too political and it was too administrative and it would take him away from the four cubits of halacha, from the opportunity to be studying Torah. But my interest now is not so much why he turned it down, but why he was interested in it to begin with. What does this tell us about his thinking in terms of where he stands vis-a-vis the state of Israel? Source number two. In an interview that he granted shortly after deciding not to pursue the position, he was first asked, why did you turn it down? And he explained fully why he turned it down. And then the question is, source number two, if you knew all this, why did your final decision take so long? I mean, what were you thinking about till now? If it's so obvious to you, and you sure made a great case why you turned it down, why did you consider it? I considered submitting my candidacy for the following three reasons. Number one, it's difficult to reject an offer coming from Jews in Israel. It's similar to a Jewish law that an offer from an eminent person should not be refused. In other words, it depends on who the offerer is. If somebody offers you something or asks you something, and they happen to be an important person, you can't just blow it away. You can't just reject it. So since it came from a significant source, namely from the land of Israel, from the state of Israel, from what he calls Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, so clearly I couldn't just simply reject it. I had to consider it seriously, number one. Number two, I received many letters urging me to run from rabbis in Israel who otherwise do not mix into politics and have no ulterior motives. And mixing into politics is the kiss of death for Rabbi Soloveitchik, but they don't do that. They're good people. They're good rabbis. And they felt that I could contribute, so therefore I took it seriously. And number three, I dreamt that I would be able to improve the chief rabbinate. At which point the interviewer jumps in and says, wow, that sounds interesting. How are you going to improve the chief rabbinate? And he lays out a different number of ways how he thought he could actually make a difference. And he could turn the chief rabbinate not into some technical organizational position, but a spiritual position, that he could revamp the whole office of the chief rabbinate. He describes here, get rid of the ceremonies and get rid of the formalities and focus on the important things, change the institutional structure of the office of the chief rabbinate. He thought maybe he could somehow affect it in a positive way, but he realized that that wasn't going to happen. So even though the invitation came from a very important source, and even though he got a number of letters from people who he respected, at the end of the day, he withdrew from consideration for the position, and he remained the United States until the end of his life. I want to now examine a couple of his writings that describe his understanding of the role of the state of Israel. He was pretty much in the world of Torah alone in this perspective and in presenting this ideology. Particularly in the United States, most great, renowned, towering Torah scholars were more, at best, neutral on Zionism. And he really staked his flag and his reputation in favor of religious Zionism. And here he actually does explain what motivated him to do so. We already saw his own words describing the transition to what is known as Mizrahi religious Zionism. Source number three. These all come from, the first of these next few sources come from the book The Rav Speaks. Once again, this is the collection of talks that he gave at the annual conventions of the Religious Zionists of America. You may ask, source number three. You may ask, what is the attitude of Orthodoxy to the State of Israel? I cannot speak in the name of all Orthodoxy, because all Orthodoxy pretty much didn't agree with him, or lots of Orthodoxy did not agree with him. At present, I'm speaking on my own behalf, but I think that many will agree with me. Certainly, our attitude is positive. Can it possibly be otherwise? Which faithful Jews can be against Israel? Let us put it simply, God created the State of Israel. Now, if you want to give something significance, there's probably no more stronger way to give it significance than to say, God created it. It's godly. God made this. If God made it, so it's important and it's significant. Can flesh and blood be so brazen as to oppose it? My acquaintances, my students know my outlook on this subject well. But, and here comes a but. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, the State of Israel was not, I already mentioned it, an end in and of itself. It's not just, we have a state, perfect, great, we're good to go. But the state is but one bank of the river. The river of Jewish existence has another bank. Over the bank stand generations of the sages of tradition, generations who strengthened our heroic existence, the quality of heroism, generations who sanctified our existence with their blood. We are at one with those generations beyond the river. From those generations, our roots suck their life nourishment. To those generations over the river, on the other side of the river, our souls and hearts belong. We admire the state. Yes, we do. Of course, we have to admire the state. God, after all, created the state. With all our heart, we pray for her welfare. We send her our sons and stand united to defend her. But it is not the highest good. Our highest ideal is our faith. At the end of the day, state is important, but more important is faith. And the state is only important insofar as it could be an instrument to strengthen our faith. The bottom of this quote, if the question is put to us, what do you choose? A secular state of Israel that has cut off, far be it, God forbid, all connection with the Hebrew tradition from over the river or the God of Israel, if that's your choice, then it must be clearly understood that all of us with one voice will choose the God of Israel. If, God forbid, it has to come down to the God of Israel or the State of Israel, it's going to be the God of Israel, hands down. Source number four. The first fundamental truth of our movement, paragraph beginning, the first fundamental truth of our movement is the intuitive conviction that the foundation and existence of the State of Israel must be seen as a miraculous act of immense moment in the history of our times. That's a very powerful theological statement. It's a miracle. It's a miracle means it's divine. Again, God made a miracle. Human beings don't make miracles. Only the loving kindness of God, which is from everlasting unto everlasting, made it possible. And once again, the State of Israel is functional. The purpose of the State of Israel is it helps us reach our real goal. The State of Israel will help us, the Jews of the diaspora, to preserve our identity and self-pride. I do not say that it alone can afford us the great protection for our continued existence as a people, parenthesis, especially in the diaspora. But one thing is certain, it will greatly alleviate our efforts to exist as a small island in the midst of a raging sea of assimilation, hatred, and spiritual fragmentation. The fact that the State of Israel exists helps us in the diaspora be stronger, be more rooted, be more confident in our existence. It helps alleviate some of the challenges that we face. Source number 5. I want to add something. And here, this is, in my mind, one of the most powerful expressions of Rabbi Soloveitchik's thinking. He's addressing himself not to the theological significance of the state of Israel, but to the flag of Israel. So for my whole life, I thought that a flag is just sort of like a conventional thing. Every nation has a flag. Every nation has a particular form that reflects its value. It has a seal. It has a flag. But it's not that. It's much more. I want to add something. If you ask me, how do I, a Talmudic Jew, very significant, how does he define himself? I am a Talmudic Jew. How do I, as a Talmudic Jew, look upon the flag of the state of Israel? Has it any halachic value? Again, value is defined by halacha. If it has halachic value, it has value. If it has no halachic value, it has no value. So if you ask me, does this flag of the state of Israel have value, the only way I could conceptualize such a question is that does it have some kind of a religious value, some kind of a Jewish, legal, meaningful, authentic, spiritual value. Now you're talking. That's called value. Does the flag have such a value? I would answer plainly. So first of all, he says, I don't hold at all with the magical attraction of a flag or similar symbolic ceremonies. I'm not into the symbol. I'm not into the ceremony. You know, there are laws of ceremony with flags. So the flag is full mast, the flag is half mast. At a funeral of a soldier, that you take the flag and there's a whole entourage and it's folded in a certain way. There are laws about flags. There are ceremonies about flags. I'm not into that whatsoever, he says. I'm not into ceremony. I'm not into symbolism. Nonetheless, we must not lose sight of a law in the Code of Jewish Law. To the effect, the Code of Jewish Law says, one who has been killed by non-Jews is buried in his clothes so that his blood may be seen and avenged. It's an amazing concept. According to traditional Jewish law, when somebody passes away, there's a whole procedure preparing the body for burial. And part of that procedure includes washing the body. There are burial societies, men for men, women for women. It's done with unbelievable, exquisite kindness, sensitivity, and reverence. I've had the privilege personally many times to participate. There's a dead body. It's quiet. It's respectful. And the body is prepared for burial before it's put into the coffin. At the end, we always speak to the dead body and we ask forgiveness if we did anything that was inappropriate to you. It's just unbelievably meaningful and spiritual. But if someone is killed because there's a Jew, because they are a Jew, one who has been killed by non-Jews because they're a Jew, if somebody is killed as a soldier, if somebody's blown up in a bus, if somebody's rammed in a car, if somebody dies because they're Jewish and there's blood on their clothes, forget the washing the body. Forget the cleaning. Forget the sanitizing. Forget the making nice. The body is buried, according to Jewish law, in the coffin, all bloodied up, with the clothes, with the blood on the clothes. And the reason is because this body is going to go up to God, and this body says to God, this is enough. This is obscene. This has to stop. In your face, God, we put the Jewish blood. God, you can't let this happen. I'm not going to let you look away from this. You see this in front of you, blood dripping. It's not nice. It's not fancy. It's not clean. It's not fixed. That's what Jewish law says. And this is Jewish law. Bury the body messed up, blown up, bloody, dripping with the clothes in the coffin to go right up to God and say this can't happen. In other words, extrapolates Rabbi Soloveitchik, the clothes of the Jew acquire a certain sanctity when splattered with the blood of a martyr. There's something holy. There is a tradition in Jewish life, a holy object cannot be simply thrown into the garbage. A holy object has to be put away in an appropriate, proper, holy place. The clothes of such a person are holy. They're not thrown away. They can't be dispensed with. They're buried. That's what we do with holy objects, Torah scroll, other objects, when we can't use them anymore. The way we dispose of them respectfully is not to throw them in the garbage, but to bury them. That's what we do with a human being. That's what we do with clothes, bloody clothes, of someone who is killed because they're a Jew. The clothes acquire a sanctity and have to be treated accordingly. How much more is this so of the blue and white flag, which has been immersed in the blood of thousands of young Jews who fell in the War of Independence defending the country and the population? And one would add, since Rabbi Soloveitchik said these words, after the War of Independence, in 1956 and in 1967 and in 1973 and regretfully. The story continues. How much more so is this of the blue and white flag, which has been immersed in the blood of thousands of young Jews who fell in the War of Independence defending the country and the population. And then he says, religious and irreligious. The enemy didn't differentiate between them. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if you're a pious soldier or not a pious soldier. It has a spark of sanctity that flows from devotion and self-sacrifice. We are all enjoined to honor the flag and treat it with respect. I must tell you that since the day I read this passage, when I look at an Israeli flag, I don't see two colors. I see three colors. I see blue, and I see white, and I see red. What a powerful expression of a commitment. This is not a state, this is a flag. Who cares about the flag? Every country has a flag, it's a flag. Everybody, you can't be a country unless you have a flag. How can you not have a flag? But the flag is not just a flag. The flag of Israel has sanctity. Powerful expression of Rabbi Soloveitchik's commitment, not only to the state of Israel, but also to the flag of Israel. It is, however, clear, and it is, however, obvious, and by now it should already be obvious to you from my own presentations, that Rabbi Soloveitchik most clearly presents his position on the significance of the State of Israel in the lecture that he first gave in 1956 at Yeshiva University on Israel Independence Day, published in Hebrew in 1960 and translated by Professor Lawrence Kaplan in this version as Fate and Destiny. The Hebrew title comes from part of a verse in the book of Song of Songs. Just to step back for a minute and to reflect, if the key work in Unit 2, Rabbi Soloveitchik and the Torah-only world, is Halachic Man, and if the key work in Unit 3, Rabbi Soloveitchik and Torah and is Lonely Man of Faith, then the key work in Unit 6, Rabbi Soloveitchik and Zionism, is Fate and Destiny. The Hebrew title comes from a verse in Song of Songs, source number 6. The Hebrew is, and I will translate it, Kol Dodi Do fake. I gave you the original Hebrew in source number 6. We will operate with the English translation. Verse number 2, chapter 5. I was asleep. The woman is speaking. I was asleep, but my heart was wakeful. Hark! My beloved knocks. Hebrew. Kol. A voice. Dodi, do fake. My beloved is knocking. as opposed to a more standard translation, Kol Dodi Dofek, the voice of my beloved is knocking. That's not how it's translated here, and I think the way it's translated here is correct. Kol, exclamation point, a voice, hark, Dodi Dofek, my beloved is knocking. Let me in, says the beloved, the man is now speaking. Let me in, my own, my darling, my faultless dove. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. I'm knocking at the door. Let me in, says the woman. I've already taken off my bathrobe. What, I'm supposed to put it on again? I already bathed my feet. Am I going to make them dirty again? If I get out of bed and I go to the door, my feet are going to get dirty. My beloved took his hand off the latch, and my heart was stirred for him. Finally. He's knocking, and I'm in bed, and he's knocking, and I'm in bed, and he's knocking, and I'm too tired, and he's knocking because I don't want to schlep and put my bathrobe on and put on my slippers. Finally, I get out of bed. I rose to let in my beloved. My hands drip myrrh, my fingers flowing myrrh upon the handles of the bolt. I'm all excited. I open the door, but my beloved has turned and gone. I came too late. Said, wrote Rabbi Soloveitchik, source number 7, English translation, Professor Lawrence Kaplan. It is gripping. It's extraordinary. I want to read it. The Hebrew is masterful and poetic. The English translation is incredible. What is the gist? First full paragraph, source number 7. Of the Song of Songs, of the few, just 4 verses or so that I just read to you. If not the description of the tragic and paradoxical delay of the Shulamite maiden, drunk with love and overwhelmed with yearning. When a favorable moment replete with awe and majesty beckoned to her, if not her missing that great, exalted, and momentous opportunity that she had dreamed about, fought for, and sought so passionately. The tender and delicate Shulamite maiden, impelled by longing for her bright-eyed beloved, roamed through, during sun-drenched days, through the bypaths of vineyards and over the crests of mountains, through fields and gardens, and during pale, magical, moonlight nights, during pitch-black nights between the walls, all of this time, all over the place, searching for her beloved. One cold and rainy night, she returned to her tent, tired, worn out, she fell asleep. The sound of quick and light footsteps could be heard in the silence of the tent. On that strange and mysterious night, suddenly the beloved emerged from out of the dark and knocked on the door of his darling, who had intensely yearned for and awaited him all these years. And now he showed up. He knocked and he pleaded with her to open the door. Open the door, open it. It's the voice of my beloved that knocks. Open me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my undefiled. The great moment that she had looked forward to with such impatience and longing materialized all of a sudden, unexpectedly. Her elusive, self-concealing beloved, tired of wandering and hardships, appeared, and here comes the poetry, appeared with his curly hair, his black eyes, his powerful build, his radiant countenance. He stood by her door. He stretched his hand in through the hole in the latch, sought refuge from the damp of the night, wished to tell her about his powerful love, about his desires, his yearnings, about a life that he wanted with her of companionship, filled with delight and joy about the realization and attainment of their aspirations. He's here. Please, I want to connect to you. I want to relate to you. I want to share my life, my destiny, my world with you. Only one little thing was necessary. Only the slight movement of stretching out her hand and turning the latch intervened between her and her beloved, between the great dream and its complete fulfillment. With a single leap, the Shulamite maiden could have obtained her heart's longing. She wanted this forever. And now she had it. Draw me and we'll run after you, we'll be glad and rejoice, but the heart is deceitful. And who can discern it? Precisely on that very night, a strange and stubborn insolence overcame her. For a brief moment, the fire of longing that had burned so brightly was dimmed. The fierce passion ebbed. Her emotions were stilled. Her dreams extinguished. She refused to descend from the bed. She didn't open the door to her handsome beloved. A cruel madness swept her into an abyss of oblivion and indifference. The maiden proved stubborn, lazy, rained down a multitude of excuses and rationalizations. I took off my bathrobe, I took off my slippers, what, I'm gonna get up and I'm in my nightgown and I'm not dressed and I'm gonna get dirty. The beloved knocked again and knocked again. And the more insistent his knocks, the louder they grew, the more icy, defiling madness. Her icy, defiling madness increased in intensity as the whispered entreaties of the beloved pierced the silence of the night. Come on, this is unbelievable. This is poetry. This is amazing. This is all three verses in the Song of Songs. Just beautifully, incredibly, imaginatively described. The whispered entreaties of the beloved pierced the silence of the night. The heart of his darling became harder and harder like stone. The beloved continued to knock, pleading patiently. And together with his knocks, the clock sounded the minutes and the hours. The maiden paid no heed to the voice of her beloved. The door to her tent remained shut up tight. The moment was lost. And the vision of an exalted life faded away. It is true. Yeah, you're right. It's true that after a brief delay, she finally woke up. The maiden awoke from her slumber and, confused and startled, leapt from her bed to welcome. I rose up, verse 5, to open to my beloved, but she arose too late. Her beloved had stopped knocking and vanished into the darkness of the night. Her life's joy was fled, her existence a desolate wilderness and empty waste. The saga of her passionate quest began anew. She was this close, and now she has to start all over again. She is still wandering amidst the shepherd's tents, searching for her beloved. Now comes the application of this to the state of Israel. You can't really get it unless you understand the context, which is why I took a little extra time to present the backstory. The backstory is essential. The front story is incomprehensible without understanding where this image is rooted. Kol Dodi Dofek, the name of the essay, the title. Hark, my beloved is knocking. 8 years ago, 1956, minus 8 in 1948, 8 years ago, in the midst of a night of terror filled with the horrors of Majdanek, Treblinka, and Buchenwald, in a night of gas chambers and crematoria, in a night of absolute divine self-concealment, in a night ruled by the Satan of doubt and apostasy, which sought to sweep the maiden from her house into the Christian church, in a night of continuous searching, of questing for the beloved, 1948 minus 3, 1945, the end of the Holocaust. On that night, in that very night, the beloved appeared. God, who conceals himself in his dazzling hiddenness, suddenly manifested himself and began to knock at the tent of his despondent and disconsolate love, twisting convulsively on her bed, suffering the pains of hell. The woman is the Jewish people. The lover is God himself. As a result of the knocks on the door of the maiden wrapped in mourning, the state of Israel was born. Can there be no more powerful and profound description and assertion of the divinity of the state of Israel than this? The knocker in the biblical text is God himself. And you're already understanding the rest of the imagery. And this whole presentation is designed to tell the Jews in 1956, don't stay in bed. Don't be lazy. Jump out of bed. Grab a hold of that door. Welcome in the beloved before you will lose this incredible, majestic, magical, divine opportunity. How many times did the beloved knock on the door of the tent of his love? It appears to me that we can count six knocks. These six knocks, and I'm just going to lay out each one of them for you, describe in detail the significance that Rabbi Soloveitchik ascribes to the state of Israel, to the founding of the state of Israel. First, the knock of the beloved was heard in the political arena. First, he says, this is unbelievable. He says, my God, the United States and Russia both voted in favor of Israel. Politically, this was cataclysmic. People who otherwise didn't see eye to eye, politically or otherwise, joined forces in support of the state of Israel. And then he goes on to say something that is not without contemporary significance. Both Russia and the Western countries jointly supported the idea of the establishment of the state. This was perhaps the only proposal where East and West were united. I am inclined to believe that the United Nations organization was created specifically for this purpose, in order to carry out the mission which divine providence had set for it. It seems to me that one cannot point to any other concrete achievement on the part of the United Nations. Who needs the United Nations? I know why we have a United Nations. Because, my God, they founded the state of Israel. They voted. America, Russia, United Nations. It was good for one thing. It should have dropped dead after that, okay? Nothing else of value, okay? That's why it existed. Knock number one. Second knock. The knocking of the beloved could be heard on the battlefield. The small Israeli defense forces defeated the mighty armies of the Arab countries. The miracle of the many in the hands of the few took place. What a miracle, what a knock. My God, it was like 100 million to 28,000. The odds were crazy. What a miracle, knock. God knocked and allowed the Israeli defense forces to defend themselves and to create the state of Israel. Third, the beloved began to knock as well on the door of the theological tent. Christians had always argued, it's known technically as the argument of historical empiricism. History has proven that we're right and you're wrong. Isn't it obvious, Christians said throughout the Middle Ages, God loves us, God doesn't love you. We have all the power, we have all the strength. We have all the money, we have everything, and you're like so discriminated against, you're persecuted. We want you to stay in the country, you'll stay in the country. We want to kick you out, we'll kick you out. We have everything. We are the ones who are so powerful. And all of a sudden, knock number three, comes the Jewish state and says, who has the force? Who has the power? Who has the army? It gives a lie, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, knock number three, to the, I'm tempted to say millennia, but certainly centuries old argument of Christianity against Judaism. Fourth, the beloved is knocking in the hearts of the perplexed and assimilated youths. He alluded to this earlier in a previous source. We're having trouble in America. People are assimilating. People are giving up. People are not wanting to commit themselves. Forget about even Jewish religious tradition, even to Jewish identity. But the existence of the state of Israel makes us proud. Makes us proud. I remember in 1967, I was not born in 1948. I remember in 1967, I don't know, but I felt like I could walk with a measure of, I'm not such a tall guy, but I mustered all my non-tallness to feel tall. I walked around with a kippah. I felt like this is so important. My identity now, I'm proud to be a Jew. Like, look what they did in Israel. Look what Israel is, 1948, maybe even more so. Knock number four, we have something Jewish to be proud of, a national entity that we can identify with. Knock number five, The fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important of all. For the first time in the history of our exile, divine providence has surprised our enemies with a sensational discovery. Oh my God, Jewish blood is not free for the taking. See, throughout the medieval period, Jews had no power, Jews had no strength. They were vulnerable. They were pitifully vulnerable. You want to kill a Jew? Kill a Jew. What are the implications? Zero. Zero. The American Jewish Committee didn't exist. The Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith didn't exist. Kill Jews. Okay, kill Jews. Oh, knock. Number five. Can't do that anymore. You're going to want to kill a Jew. The Jew is going to defend himself. Jewish blood is no longer free for the taking. Knock number six. Knock number six is, wow, Jews have a place to go. The sixth knock, which we must not ignore, was heard when the gates of the land were open. A Jew who flees from a hostile country now has where to go. You remember what happened with the St. Louis? Just think for a second. I often ask my audiences to come along with me for a moment on the thought experiment. Just imagine for a second, if the state of Israel had been founded just 10 years before it was founded. It's not a long time. Just 10 years before it was founded. If it was founded in 1938 instead of 1948, you know what the Jewish world would look like now? It's just incomparable. In 1948, when Jews needed a place to run, they had a place to go. And they were welcomed. And they are welcomed. The St. Louis couldn't happen. This one didn't want them, and this one didn't want them, and this one didn't want them. They ended up back certain death, back in Germany. And so many Jews had nowhere to go, no man's land. They were nationless. There was no state of Israel. Knock number six. What amazing knocks. What amazing descriptions of a power, of the fundamental, divine, godly significance of the state of Israel. I want to make three final points. Point number one, Rabbi Soloveitchik's support for religious Zionism and the state of Israel needs to be seen as part of a broader context of his belief that we have already seen, that there's an obligation on the part of the Jew to take an active role in the world. In other words, I'm framing now his Zionism, not in terms of Zionism, but as part of his overall ideology of activism and engagement. You remember Adam 1 in unit number 3? You remember the proactive, practical, engaged in the world Adam? You remember the partner with God in creation, Adam? You remember the dominating nature and bringing the world under his control, Adam? This Adam is not just a person. This Adam is not just a human being. This Adam is a people. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, the people needs to be an Adam. The people needs to be active and engaged and take a role in determining its own fate as a people. This is not the quiet, passive role assigned to the Jewish people by Rabbi Soloveitchik's own ancestors. And I quote, "My medal, why meddle in the secrets of the merciful one?" The contrary. A Torah life is a Torah of life, and it demands active engagement in the world and not separation from the world. It requires a Jew to actively build a Torah society in a Jewish state in the land of Israel. And so point number one is that Rabbi Soloveitchik's attitude to Zionism fits squarely, I believe, within his general philosophical perspective. Point number two. In Rabbi Soloveitchik's day, especially after the stunning victories of Israel during the Six-Day War, much of religious Zionist thought had a very prominent messianic component, beginning with the founding of the State of Israel, but accelerating hugely with the amazing miracles of June of 1967. There were many in the religious Zionist camp who heard the footsteps of the Messiah. We have this sentiment already expressed in the formal prayer for the State of Israel that was constructed, promulgated, written, authored by the Chief Rabbinate in 1948. Turn, please, to source number 8. The State of Israel in this prayer is referred to in messianic terms. Heavenly Father, Israel's Rock and Redeemer, bless thou the State of Israel. How is the State of Israel referred to? The first flowering of our redemption. It is formulated in redemption, messianic categories. Okay, I get it. Messiah isn't here yet. There actually is a double hedge. It's not the flowering, it's the first flowering. We haven't really flowered yet either. We're beginning to flower, and then we have to finish flowering, and then the redemption is gonna come. So I get the double hedge, but the State of Israel is framed within the context, within the box of redemption, of messianism. Rabbi Soloveitchik was unalterably opposed to this concept. He was concerned that excesses might, and in fact he believed did, result from a messianic conception of the state. He believed that various irresponsible positions were being taken by significant figures and groups and maybe even movements in the State of Israel as a result of their conviction that they were, after all, the Messiah is coming. Messiah is coming, so if the Messiah is coming, I can do what I think I can do. I don't have to worry about anything. He was opposed to it. Rabbi Soloveitchik never recited the prayer for the government of Israel as it is formulated, including the reference to the state as messianic. And now my third point, and I think one of my most significant points. Rabbi Soloveitchik's Zionism was a diaspora Zionism. You remember early on, right when I started, I said, what does it mean to be a Zionist and living in the diaspora? Who are you kidding? I mean, come on. How could you be a Zionist and not live in Israel? You know, we're in the 21st century. There's the State of Israel. Get on a plane, go over there, and you'll figure it out. So you won't have your three-car garage and your 19 bedrooms. You'll be in some hole in the old city. Okay, you'll figure it out. But so then don't call yourself a Zionist. I mean, if you're a Zionist, how can you defend not being in Israel? Rabbi Soloveitchik is a model of a Zionist who did not live in Israel. And now my final source. Source number 9. In 1967, right after the Six-Day War, he got a letter from a woman by the name of Miriam Shiloh. Miriam Shiloh was a teacher in Israel, and she taught Fate and Destiny. Obviously in Israel, she taught it in the original Hebrew. So I'm gonna repeat the original Hebrew title, Kol Dodi Dofeik, to her students. And she writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, we don't have her letter, but we have his letter back. Regretfully, we only have a one way, but we know exactly what she asked. Rabbi Soloveitchik, what are you waiting for? I mean, the Six-Day War, miracles. I had the privilege to be in Jerusalem 10 days after the Six-Day War. Oh my God, euphoria. You are a Zionist. I teach your Kol Dodi Dofeik. Knocks, 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 knocks. God knocked in 1956. God is knocking now. You got to be kidding. It's all over the place. Come to Israel. Move to Israel. And he writes back, I'm not moving to Israel. And Rabbi Soloveitchik's most poignant, personal, powerful, self-reflective description is in this letter. To the Honorable Mrs. Miriam Shiloh, may your living be well, greetings and blessings. I apologize for not responding to your letter immediately and for my tardiness until now. It was and remains very difficult for me to write. I was immersed in the mourning for my beloved wife. This is now July 1967. She died just a few months earlier, in 1967. Rabbi Soloveitchik's wife was the most important figure in his life. After his father, chronologically, his father was obviously first. His father loomed huge for him. His wife was absolutely his best friend. He was closer to her. She meant more to him than anybody else or anything else in the world. She died. He was absolutely smashed. He would go every Friday. I told you that he would commute back and forth. Friday, he's back in Boston, leaves Tuesday, comes back Thursday. Every Friday, for years, he went to her grave in the cemetery. Every single Friday, for years. He was extremely close to her. It's now just a few months, and I am depressed. I am immersed in mourning for my beloved wife, the apple of my eye, the desire of my soul. May her memory be a blessing. My world collapsed and was destroyed. Even now, I write to you with tears and the blood of my torn and tortured heart. I thank you for your words and I accept your rebuke. You're right, I sinned. You rebuke me. You rebuke me by saying, Rabbi, what are you doing in Boston? You know what? You're right. I accept your rebuke. I have sinned against the Holy Land. Of course, many factors that were out of control prevented me. In spite of this, I'm not searching for an excuse, nor am I justifying myself. I am guilty, and the blame rests on my shoulders. You should know, he says, that last year, my wife, may her memory be for a blessing, and I decided to come to Israel and remain for about 6 months to see the land and the people, but didn't work out. What happened, happened. What happened? She got sick and she died. And my sighs are many and my heart is sick. Many of my friends and acquaintances are urging me to come now. You also said that now is really a good time to go. But I can't come because Jewish law says that a money-changing booth cannot be in Jerusalem. Do you know why a money-changing booth cannot be in Jerusalem? Because inevitably, parenthesis, willy-nilly, end parenthesis, you're going to feel that you didn't get what you should have gotten. You go to the money changer, right? You go to a money changer, you go to a foreign country, you change the money, And they start giving you, and you're sitting there and you're trying to figure out the exchange rate, and you think you got gypped. It happens all the time, and you're going back and you're figuring out to the decimal and the percentage. Somehow you feel like you got rooked, and you're going to get rooked, and you're going to feel angry. Oh, can't feel angry in Jerusalem. Can't be depressed in Jerusalem. So you can't have a money-changing booth in Jerusalem. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, if I go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be violating the law because I'm depressed. There's no place for a depressed person in Jerusalem. How much more so is it true regarding a state of bleak mourning that I am in? I'm not just depressed because I feel like I got cheated by a money changer. I am existentially, massively, totally depressed, and therefore I can't go to Jerusalem. You do not, final paragraph, have to justify yourself. I get it. I get what you're saying to me. I too, a simple Jew, would say in the words of the rabbis of Yavne, I teach, and many others who work in the field of Torah education teach. My work happens to be in a large city of New York, in an institution, namely Yeshiva University, with a great number of students. And other teachers work in Givat Washington. That is a school in Israel, where I am assuming Miriam Shiloh was a teacher. So I teach over here, and you teach over there, or some other settlement in a similarly small institution. One may do much, one may do little. It is all one, provided she or he directs her or his heart to heaven. All our work is dedicated to the flourishing of the values of Judaism, the tradition of our forefathers and our sages, the bearers of the tradition and its scholars. With great respect, Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, and he did not go. This is 1967. He died in 1993. Why didn't he ever go? Why didn't he ever go? Go? So don't make Aliyah. Visit? Never visited. He was in Israel once in his life. When was he in Israel? 1935. 4 months he tried out for the job of Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv. Once in his life, 67, he didn't go. I'm depressed. 70, 75, 80, 84, he got sick. 20 years, he could have gone. Almost 20 years, he could have gone. His daughter moved to Israel, his younger daughter. Son-in-law, the Lichtenstein family, grandchildren living in Israel. They visited him. He never visited them. I wondered about this for a long time. And everybody has a theory why he didn't go, and then I got the answer. His daughter and late son-in-law live in a place called Gush Etzion, and his son-in-law, her husband, was head of a very prominent yeshiva, Yeshivat Har Etzion. It's a yeshiva in Israel that has a one-year American program, which means that there are a number of boys from various high schools across the United States and throughout the world who take a gap year between high school and starting university to study in Israel, and many of them go to this institution. There's somebody in charge of this program, or was in charge of this program. His name is Rabbi Rani or Reuven Ziegler, who is the author of Majesty and Humility, a very important and central work that features an excellent presentation of the life and thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he always wanted the boys to meet Mrs. Lichtenstein, Rabbi Soloveitchik's daughter. They saw him, the rabbi, a lot in class, in school. He gave many lectures. She didn't have a public role in the school. She's a formidable personality in her own right. She's Rabbi Soloveitchik's daughter. So Rabbi Ziegler wanted the boys to get to meet her. And she never had time. Once in a weak moment, Rabbi Ziegler told me, she said, okay, bring the boys for the third meal on the Sabbath. So he runs right out of the room, gets the guys, arranges it, they walk in. And in this particular school, in this particular yeshiva, they often had with her husband what they would call press conferences. So a press conference is where Rabbi Lichtenstein is standing there, and you ask him anything you want. No holds barred, ask whatever you want. So they figured, the boys, that they're gonna do the same thing in the house with her. So they sit down, and they have a little ginger ale and a little potato chip and some kind of an egg salad. And then the press conference. Mrs. Lichtenstein, why didn't your father ever go to Israel? Why didn't he ever go to Israel? Rabbi Ziegler tells me this is what she answered. I'll tell you why he never went to Israel. He never went to Israel because my mother always wanted to go to Israel. But he was too busy. In the 60s, he was too busy. He was writing in the summer. He went to a little small community outside of Boston. And he would study and he would write, and old boys would come and spend 6 weeks studying with him. He had what to do, he was busy. Finally, as we just read in his letter to Mrs. Shilo, 6 months ago in 1966, he finally said, okay, we're gonna go. We're gonna go for 6 months. And then what happened? She died. Said Mrs. Lichtenstein, my father could never bring himself to go to Israel after she died. How can he enjoy something that he denied her? So this is not ideology, this is not theology, this is not philosophy. This is a man in love with his wife. I didn't let her have this. How is it possible that I could have this? And so he never even went for a visit. In this unit, Rabbi Soloveitchik played a very leading role in delineating attitudes within the Jewish community for a particularly Jewish issue, namely Zionism in the State of Israel. Rabbi Soloveitchik also played a leadership role in delineating attitudes on issues relating to outside, specifically of the Jewish community, in particular relating to the relationship between Jews and non-Jews in the world in which we lived. And it is to one of these issues, Jewish-Christian dialogue, that I will draw our attention to in our next unit. Thank you.
There are so many scriptural resources Rabbi Soloveitchik could have turned to think through the questions posed by Zionism. And it's not obvious why one would think about Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, as a way to think through this question. Why do you think his mind went to that place?
For a long time, I used to think that the reason why Rabbi Soloveitchik went to that particular biblical book and text to unpack and unfold his religious Zionist ideology was because he was mounting an implicit, maybe even explicit critique of Rabbi Joel Teitelbaum, who was the Rebbe of Satmar, who was one of the most outspoken anti-Zionist leaders and thinkers of the 20th century. Rabbi Teitelbaum was absolutely and unalterably opposed to Zionism, went even so far as to say that the reason why the Holocaust happened, and I know this is shocking, was because of Zionism. God was punishing the Jewish people for being Zionists. They were pushing where they shouldn't have pushed. They were active when they should have been passive. And the text that Rabbi Teitelbaum uses is this book, The Song of Songs, based on a passage in the Talmud, the book Song of Songs has three phrases that are repeated. I am giving you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, known throughout subsequent Jewish history through the Talmudic prism as the three oaths, one of which is Jews have no right, took an oath not to force the end of days, but rather to be passive. And when God wants the Jews to return to Zion, God will return the Jews to Zion. And that Zionism is a violent betrayal of that oath that the Jews took. And so I thought for a long time that Rabbi Soloveitchik went specifically to this text as a polemic against Rabbi Teitelbaum, to use this very text as the anchor for a totally different, actually opposite perspective. And then I read a medieval work entitled The Kuzari by Judah Halevi. Judah Halevi was a very prominent medieval Spanish poet and philosopher, wrote this book in the 11th century into the 12th century, wrote this book. And in his book has a dialogue between what he calls the king of the Khazars, who he sets up as the one who asks questions, and the rabbi who answers the questions. Conceptually, it's interesting for somebody to present one's thought, not in a standard way, but through the medium of a dialogue. The book is set up as a dialogue. And the king asks Judah Halevi, tell me, why is Zion, Zion, Israel so important for you? So the rabbi responds, marshaling an array of evidence based on a number of rabbinic sources, biblical sources about how important Zion is. At which point, the king of the Khazar says, so I don't get it. Why are you in Spain? Based on what you just told me, you should be in Israel. And Judah Halevi puts into the mouth of the rabbi, you're 100% right. And it is for this reason that the second temple was not as great as the first temple, Because when God destroyed the first temple and now made it possible for Jews to return with the building of the second temple, most Jews did not go back. And God was knocking at the gate of the Jewish people, inviting them to return to Zion. And they did not hear the knock. And they did not respond to the knock. Yehuda HaLevi is the first one to use these very verses in the context of God knocking at the gates of the Jewish people, inviting them back to Zion. We think that Rabbi Soloveitchik, and as we know by now with good reason, was enamored by Maimonides and was greatly influenced by Maimonides. We don't appreciate enough the influence that HaLevi had on Rabbi Soloveitchik. These were two different philosophers with different perspectives on the world of faith and reason. It wasn't only Maimonides who impacted Rabbi Soloveitchik this way. In the world of Jewish philosophy, Yehuda HaLevi had a very great impact. And here, to my mind, and here's where I believe the answer lies to your question, here's why he went to that particular text, because he was so taken by HaLevi's previous use of this particular text in this particular context. And so I think I was wrong when I thought it had to do with Rabbi Teitelbaum. I don't think anymore it has to do with Rabbi Teitelbaum. I think the answer lies here.